Welcome, everybody, to a very special episode of the NerdWatch podcast and television series. I, of course, am G-Money. I'd like to welcome all of you to a very, very special, I guess you could say phenomenally special, because we have a legend, a comic book legend in the house this evening. It's going to be a great time. We're going to talk a lot about his work and his... you could say his contribution to the comic book industry. So, first of all, I'd like to introduce our guest of honor, of course, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Joe Rubenstein is here this evening, comic book legend. Also joining us is Todd Bernardi, local comic book artist. He's going to be here. He's got questions, things like that. And then, of course, the phenomenal artist from the islands, Theo Lee, is here as well. And Theo, who is the lovely lady sitting next to you?
Your manager.
That's Amy. Get right on that mic
That's
so I can hear you. Okay, good.
Joe here too.
Good, good. And of course, joining us tonight as well is, of course, the owner and proprietor of the comic book shop that you see here this evening, the one and only Alika in the house as well. All right, so let's get this thing started. Joe's on Maui. He wants to enjoy paradise, not being stuck behind with a bunch of dinghies doing an interview. So let's get right to it. Joe, thank you for being here, sir. I really appreciate it very, very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. So, Joe, let's start off with some simple questions first. Let's give everybody, for those that are not familiar, you are a legend in the comic book business. Could you give us a little bio about yourself, sir, and how you became part of this industry?
Okay. I mean, the word legend is used a lot about me, which is very weird, because nobody ever, I think, thinks of themselves as a legend, including the Lone Ranger. When I was 5 years old, I moved with the family from Israel to Brooklyn, New York. My cousin, who was 3 years older than I, had a stack of comic books, mostly the DC family. Couldn't speak the language. Right. Looked at the pictures. Must have found it amazing. I don't know that I ever saw a comic book when I lived in Israel. From there, I guess like most little kids, I picked up crayons and tried to draw my own comic books on lined paper. When I was 11 years old, amazingly enough, my father let me go to the Art Students League of New York. It's like, wow. I wouldn't let an 11-year-old on the subway. So I don't know what he was thinking. Then when I was 13 years old, I went to my first comic book convention and met one of my heroes, Dick Giordano, who later became editor-in-chief of DC Comics, who was responsible for incredible series like The Dark Knight, Watchmen, Swamp Thing. Plus, he was a wonderful artist. I did gopher work around the studio, cleaning floors, running for coffee, whatever. Mm-hmm. Dick would take out the time to show me things, give me little lessons on how to be a better artist. Probably he did more than I would have done in the same circumstance, because I would be trying to meet a deadline and Dick would actually stop and go, all right, you can do it like this. I went, okay. And also because he had a studio called Continuity Associates along with his partner, Neil Adams, who was a big groundbreaking artist in the industry. He did the really first dark Batman. He brought that back, Green Lantern, Green Arrow. Mm-hmm. He went on to do the X-Men. Mm. And then when I started to get assistant work, helping out on jobs, I wanted to be a penciler, by the way. And then I read an interview by Gil Kane, who was one of the greats who did The Flash and Atom. That he should have been an inker first just to get used to the industry. So that's what I started to do. I started to get pretty good at it. I started to do assistant work for Dick, as well as the great Wally Wood. And if you don't know who that is, go look him up. You'll do yourselves a big favor.
Right.
Russ Heath, Jack Gable. I was also assistant to Klaus Janson for a while, Bob McLeod. And then when I was 17 years old, I got my first job at DC Comics. They said, Dick, we'll give him the job if you watch him. Whatever that meant. And so I did the job,
right.
And I brought it in to Dick, and I said, so what do you think? He went, it's great. That's how he watched me. And so I was doing work then when I was 17, and then when I was 19, I got my first work at Marvel Comics, doing the Avengers 2-in-1 annual, which is Thanos fighting the Avengers and Spider-Man and the Thing. So it's kind of vaguely the basis for the next Avengers movie, I think.
Sure.
Right. And that was 41 years ago.
Wow.
So that's what I've been doing.
Now, you being in this industry, knowing where it was and where it is now, would you have had any inclinations of what this business would become to not only film and, well, the pop culture, essentially? It's become part of our Americana, as sure. It were. Did you see that happening when you were back then?
Well, I think it always was. I mean, there was a Superman radio show in right. the 40s and the TV show in the 60s. I think the difference is there's an awful lot more venues now. So there is a video game and there is the podcasts and there is the movies and the 3D version, so forth and so on. But comic books, you know, they were something special and new and magical when they debuted in the early 30s. It's just a lot of other stuff has come around sure. since, you know. Some of the big differences is in... I started working in 1975
sure.
when I was 17. All right, so I know that seems like a very, very long time ago for most of you. But it doesn't seem... It's like the old cliche. It's like, it's not once you've lived it and you go, wow, that went fast.
Right, right.
But in those days, you had to live in the New York City tri-state area because there wasn't Federal Express and there wasn't computer and so forth and so on. So you had to literally sort of come into the offices and hand in your work, pick up the next job, go back to Connecticut or Jersey or Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And consequently, everybody was, we knew each other. We'd all go to the offices together, and there would be Frank Miller, who was this, like, 19-year-old kid I used to buy lunch for because he was starving, doing these six-page weird war story, which, by the way, if I hadn't bought Frank lunches, he'd be dead today. So... you guys owe me
a debt of gratitude.
That's right, because you wouldn't have all those great comic books if Frank had died. But I have to point out that I've been studying to be an actor for a very long time.
Yes, sir.
Did you notice me in any of the Sin City movies yet?
I have not, sir.
No, I haven't been there. Frank, if you're listening. And, you know, it's like you just – When I'm a 17-year-old kid and I'm working with all these guys who've been in the business for 30, 40 years, so there's Kurt Swan, and Kurt's in his 50s, and he's drawing Superman, and there's Gil Kane, and, you know, everybody.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because unlike musicians or writers or filmmakers, I literally knew the fathers of our industry. I know knew Siegel and Shuster, you know, and amazing. I knew Jack Kirby, and I know Stan Lee.
That's incredible.
And to just say, yeah, you know, hey, Stan, what was it like in 1941 when you got the idea? You know, well, kid, I'll tell you. You know, let me go off on a tangent for a moment. As far as Stan, Stan's cool. I like Stan better away from a convention when he's just relaxed.
Right.
You know. So in the old days, when it was really hot in New York City, people would go up to the offices and they work at some spare office because it was air conditioned.
Right.
Okay. So I was up there and I'm working and, you know, I've only been doing it a year or two or something like that. And all of a sudden, in walks into the room, I'm Stanley. And of course, I'm as impressed by Stanley as anybody else
sure.
is. Right?
Sure.
And Stan has this big board of a painting of the cover of one of the black and white books that they were putting out in those days, like Dracula and Monsters and all that kind of crap.
Right.
So I'm working, and Stan takes this thing. I hope the camera can see this. And he goes to look at it, and he crouches down. As he does it, he puts his elbow right into my ink. And I think to myself, well, that was a short career. No. I mean, I was hoping for a little more. It was fun,
right.
You know. And I thought, okay. So I say, hey, you put your very expensive shirt into my ink, and my life is over. Or I don't say anything, and later he goes, hey, what happened to my, you know.
Right, right, of course.
So I say, excuse me, Mr. Lee, but you put your elbow in my ink. It happens all the time. So that was cool.
Oh, for sure.
You know. And it was more of a family situation in those days because we would have Christmas parties at the offices.
Sure.
And DC once had a Christmas party where they went to the Automat, which, if you don't know, was sort of a cafeteria style, and there was this wall of doors, little cubbyhole doors, and you put in a quarter or a dollar, whatever the hell it was, and you'd open it up, and then you'd pull out a sandwich.
Right.
Or a cup of a pie or something.
Like
you know.
The Looney Tunes cartoons.
Right.
I've seen that on that.
I've watched cartoons before. Right.
And that was like the last Automat in New York City. They had the Christmas party there one day. Once they gave out Silly String, and the Marvel offices just had a Silly String battle running up and down the aisles that day. And, you know, it's like, is this any way to run a business? Well, it's not exactly a business. You know, comic books is something else. To be creative, there has to be a certain amount of pandemonium. There has to be a certain amount of spontaneity and fun. And we're doing funny books, and it's supposed to be funny. And then as Time Warner took over and all the other people, it became very corporate.
Right.
Very buttoned down. Mm-hmm. Literally, they put up bulletproof glass at the receptionist for some disgruntled freelancer who's going to show up with an Uzi. You know, and I was doing work for an editor at Marvel, and I live in California now. And I said, hey, you know, I'm going to be up at the offices next week. Can I come by? And she said, well, I don't know. We're kind of busy. And I went, well, I mean, I'll just, you know, to meet you. She went, no, we're really, you know. And I realized I didn't take it personally. It's like they don't want people up there. Mm. They don't want fun.
Right.
We've got a business to run, you know. And so that's the thing. But now the big difference is the proliferation of conventions. Right. There used to be one convention, San Diego Con and New York Con. Big, big, big event. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Now it's three every weekend, which, by the way, I'm not complaining.
Right.
But it's what's going on. And now it's a little bit like vaudeville. You, you pick up and you go to another town.
Sure,
and there's some friends you haven't seen for 3 years. But you all move to the next town, and then somebody joins the troupe, somebody leaves the troupe.
Right.
So that's happened. But, you know, comic books were all – as a matter of fact, comic books in the 1940s, Daredevil, who doesn't look like the red guy, but he was like a black and red guy with sort of a split costume.
Right.
He sold 4 million units a month. All right.
Wow.
Can you imagine your store going through 4 million units, right? And that's because, first, it was new. It was exciting.
Sure.
Oh, my God. There weren't video games to spend your money on. There wasn't,
right.
you know, all the other things that is competing for your money.
Right.
And now it's kind of, I don't know, it's your grandfather's comic book now. It's like, oh, comic books, they're okay.
Right.
You know, but look at the new 3D whatever, let's go spend our money there.
Yeah, barely anybody knows who that old Daredevil is.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But also, it's just, you know, there's a character called Plastic Man.
I actually really enjoy Plastic Man. He's just
he's
a weird, quirky-looking guy.
He's weird, but you know why he's called Plastic Man and not Rubbery Guy? Because plastic was kind of new. It was space
That's
age.
What I figured.
Right.
It's
like,
yeah.
Let's make something amazing. So why is every Marvel superhero one way or another derivative of some kind of an atomic explosion or because now we after 1945 the atomic age has started,
right?
So that's got to be doing something,
right.
I mean, look, there was a bunch of characters called the Atomic Knights, and they used to ride like 6 foot long Dalmatians the size of horses. You know, and believe me, if a bomb drops tomorrow, we will not have 6 foot long Dalmatians in 20 years from
now.
But it's like all those monster movies in the 50s, you know, them and the ants and everything like that. It's like, what's the new interesting trend? And comic book, do you know that when Mort Weisinger, who was the editor of Superman,
right,
he would get together literally a panel of children, like 9 or 10 or 12-year-olds,
wow.
And he'd say, what do you want Superman to do this week? Make him an Indian chief. Okay. Superman's an Indian chief.
Wow.
Hey, make him so he's like a big turtle guy. Okay.
That explains the 50s.
Right, and 60s. And that's in the whole red kryptonite thing. It's like, why is Superman an Indian chief now? Because some 8-year-old wants him to be.
That's amazing.
And that's the whole
basis.
Amazing. And you know, and that's also why comic books have such a bad rap in society, because they were moronic. You know, I mean, they were simplistic and they were done for the lowest common denominator. And then as all those various people grew up,
sure,
they went, think I could put a little more into this. I think sure. I need something a little grittier.
Sure.
And then you start getting into traps like, how come Lois never noticed Clark was Superman?
Right, of course.
How does that one work?
Right.
You know, and they have to figure out some excuse that we were all just completely ignoring for years.
Right, right, right. Yeah. Now, I did notice you're talking about the fun of comic books. And one of the things that I'm old enough to remember this, but some of the most impactful comics for me were the Green Lantern and Green Arrow comics, where they really took on like social narratives,
mm-hmm.
where you know Denny O'Neill's, you know, we're talking about drug abuse, and it kind of took a weird, it wasn't weird for me, but it was very impactful because it was a very different, it was almost, it was real, but yet it was still superheroes. For a young lad like myself, reading those were very different for me because it started to kind of veer away from the fun or the moronic, as you call it.
Right.
And so are we getting back to the fun now? I mean, as far as in this new age or?
You tell me. When you read a comic book, is it fun?
Oh, I tell you, when I read comics, they're an escape. That's what I like
right,
to read them
right.
for. They provide an opportunity for me to be someone that I never thought I could be or be a part of.
Right.
So when I read those Denny O'Neill stories are amazing because they're very, you know, those are the comics that you read that keep you off of drugs kind of thing, which is really neat. But it never those socially, I guess you could say, important comics. I don't see them as often anymore. I don't know if we're going back to being a fun outlet,
well,
as it were.
Listen, I knew – I'm not talking about Denny specifically, but I knew those guys in those days. And that wasn't drug abuse. That was drug entertainment. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. I know which guys were working on acid while they did that.
Okay.
And you know, and it's also the 70s. It's also –
sure, sure.
Just let's get stoned and go draw comic books for a while.
That is insane.
You know. But, you know, I think I don't read that many comic books, partially because, you know, when we're talking about fun.
Sure.
Who I would argue is the greatest comic book character ever, not Superman and not Batman, but Spider-Man.
Wow.
Because Spider-Man is this sensitive kid who fantasizes about what would it be like to be popular and if I were strong and all the girls would like me and all the boys would
sure,
want to be my buddy.
Sure.
Like every schmuck who read a comic book as a kid who
right.
goes, I want to be this guy. And you,
it's
sure,
possible.
Right. Yeah, you can't be Superman. And,
sure.
and unless you have the privilege of your parents killed in front of you,
sure,
you can't
sure.
be Batman.
Sure.
But consequently, when Peter Parker goes off and becomes an international correspondent and he's married to a supermodel, something we all can relate to.
Sure. Of course.
It's absolutely realistic.
Right. You know, so I think that political correctness, and God knows I'm like a raving liberal, so I've got no problem with it. But
you and I should have our own podcast
because yeah.
I'm kind of a raving conservative.
Okay. Okay, let me just say, you're wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but the thing is don't make waves,
right.
don't be a problem, don't stir controversy. I mean, I think the fact that comic books have introduced so many gay characters
mm-hmm.
is pretty great
mm-hmm.
because at least they're saying, you know, this is part of life and
right.
let's mention
getting
that
people
it
into
is,
it
go- right,
right.
You know,
normally have been
right.
exposed.
And I mean, the first that I'm aware of interracial kiss in comics was in the Teen Titans between a black man and a white woman. And Dick Giordano, who was the editor of it, personally colored that page in shades of red because some sort of an effect was going on,
mm-hmm.
just so that they wouldn't exactly notice.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. And then there was a wonderful Alan Moore, who's, God knows, one of the best ever.
Sure.
When he left the series, I think it was Steve Bissett who was writing Swamp Thing, and he was going back in time through various eras. And if you read the thing, it falls flat. Something is missing.
Mm.
And it's because they did an issue where Swamp Thing is crucified and they deal with Jesus.
Yeah.
And DC went, we're not doing that.
Wow.
Okay? We don't want anybody to get mad at us.
Sure.
And, I mean, I can understand it. But on the other hand, controversy sort of makes people pay attention to what's
sure.
going on. And also, look, I'm a tremendous Josh Whedon fan, and I watch. I mean, I've watched Buffy like five cycles through.
You know, oh,
like,
crazy!
Like I give it like a year to forget what it was about. And Josh will bring this incredible, unbelievable, can't possibly get out of it scenario.
Sure.
That they somehow get out of it.
Right.
Okay. So that's fun. It's fun to watch our guys suffer. It's fun to watch our guys. How are they going to get out of it? But other people want to talk about drugs or subtly bring in their conservative or liberal slant.
That's what I've always loved about the comics, because it was like Green Arrow would bring his – he had very liberal views, but Green Lantern was very staunch in his almost right-wing views. But they would somehow – even though they were arguing, they would always work together. And I always thought that was neat. I always liked that.
But isn't that what Civil War is about, that – Arrow and Iron, you know.
Yeah, of course, of course. So I mean, when I look at these things, and when you look at comics, especially when you were working on them, they were dealing with things long before television was. Like, they were dealing with race issues through being different by being a superhero. Right. They were dealing with those issues long before TV ever could.
Well, do you know that Neil Simon, the playwright,
yes,
wanted to do a lot of his stuff on TV? Because he just wanted to get it out there faster than all the years it takes to develop a project. And Larry Gelbart, who was the writer-creator of the MASH TV series and other great, great stuff, he too wanted to just put his stuff on TV so it was still topical. Because if you're dealing with an issue, it's last week's old fish if you take any time at all. But and the thing, you know, Lorne Michaels, the executive producer of Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
He started his own comic book company called Broadway Comics.
Okay.
Jim Shooter was the editor-in-chief of it. And I think the reason Michaels did it is because he didn't want to go through $150 million worth of preparation. He just said, I got an idea. Can we put it out next month? He says, yeah.
Wow.
Let's go there.
Wow.
Let's do it.
So sitting beside you tonight, Joe, are two very independent comic book artists, local comic book artists. Theo Lee and, of course, Todd Bernardi. These guys are, I guess you could say, growing up in a very different world where you can actually publish your own comic.
Right, right.
You can do things that you were not able to do when you were making it in the business.
Yeah, there were only three networks.
Yeah, right, exactly, right. Exactly. So is the landscape of comic books better now because you can get your voice out there quicker, or are we looking at something to where it should be a little smaller, a little more regulated? Should when you look at what comics are today?
Well, look, if I am at some party and somebody says, "What do you do for a living?" and says, "I'm a comic book artist," says, "What do you do? Anything I heard of?" It says, "Superman." You ever heard of Wolverine? You know, and. It depends what your goal is, right?
Sure.
I mean, if you want to put out your comic book that you don't want people to interfere with your concept of it.
Sure.
Like, for instance, Dave Sim, who did Cerebus the Aardvark, who did it for 30 years. Mm. No kidding. How many of us say, I think I'll put out a comic book for 30 years and do it and stick with it?
Right.
I don't think anybody will ever do that again.
Sure.
But the thing is it's like when the late David Bowie was putting out his music. He was putting it out to his fans. It wasn't on the charts. It didn't become number one in the country. But he had diehard fans who bought it, who I presume helped him have a nice living. But the only way he had fans is because first he was mainstream, and they followed him. So a lot of people have plans to, I'll work for Marvel for a couple of years, people will know who I am, and then I'll go somewhere else and do my own thing and publish my own comic book. So if you want to have your own book, and you never want to compromise, because it is always has to be a compromise.
Sure.
But, you know, I mean, some people, maybe it takes off, and they make a very fine living. Because, look, the only reason we want to get paid for this stuff is so that we don't have to work at a comic book store during the day.
Hey, what's wrong with
that? Hey, don't tell that to that guy over there.
So, please, people at FedEx look down on me. Okay, but you know what I mean. It's
sure.
Don't want to, at the end of the day, have your civilian job and exhausted and says, all right, now I got to go be creative. So I want you to pay me so that I can be creative all the time. And you know, I, by the way, have never had a job my whole life. From, I mean, from 11 to 13 to 17, I've never had to go into an office and, you know, wear the clothing that the boss says you have to wear and go home at 9 o'clock. So that's really been a blessing. Mm-hmm. But to be an artist is a hard life to hoe. Unfortunately, it's the only one you can do because you can't imagine working in a hardware store. Sure. Or selling.
Well, everybody else who does those mundane jobs, all they do is dream about being an artist someday.
Yeah, yeah.
Not realizing once you make that jump, you're not going to ever come back.
I haven't given up my day job yet.
Yes.
Well, but would you like to? Would you like to start getting so much work that you just, every day you wake up at 8 o'clock and get to the board and you're happy not going anywhere else?
You're not far from there, Theo. I see you get a lot of requests and stuff.
Yeah, you know. It's just, it is a blessing, but it is also, look, the hardest part about making a living as an artist is the phone calls and getting the work. Once you get the work, it's easy. That's the easiest part about it. But to get somebody call you back, to somebody put a green light. When I discovered, if that's the word, Joe Quesada. Okay. He was working in a lighting store near the Art Students League, and I met him and I brought him up to Valiant Comics. Valiant? Whoever the hell it was. Jim Shooter was in charge of in those days. So why the hell did I bring that up? Because
he was working a soul-killing job.
So he's working a soul-killing job. You know, you're happy. So it is a blessing to be asked to do the work, and then like an actor, you see the tide go out. Huh. And you go, you know, I'm better than I ever was. Bye. Right. You know, it's like, oh, you're coming back for nostalgia? Okay, great.
Right.
And, I mean, you know, people say to me occasionally, they go, you know, he's as good as he ever was. He hasn't missed a beat. I says, was I supposed to be worse?
People expect to decline over time.
Yeah, I never think about that. That's a good point. Yeah.
I mean, some people may lose their eyesight. Like Gene Colan lost the eyesight in one eye towards the last part of his life. He still drew pretty great, right? We can't curse here, can we? Okay. He was wonderful. I mean, maybe somebody gets a tremble in their hand because they're older. I don't know. But the fact is that just because you're older doesn't mean you're not better, but there are fashion. I mean, for God's sakes, Norman Rockwell was fired from the Saturday Evening Post.
Oh, crazy.
You know, they just went, well, we're going to try something new. I turned to an editor one day, and I said, how do you pick an artist for a project? Like, let's say Dick Giordano is available. And he says, well, I always know that Dick's going to do a good job. But then I ask myself, who else is out there? And that's the mentality. So we are, oh, Quesada, there it is. Okay, so I found Joe, and he got the job, and he had an idea to do a Batman graphic novel, and I won't tell you the idea, because who knows, maybe someday it'll be done, and he's all excited. I said, Joe, it's not going to happen that fast. Okay, just be prepared for somebody's going to tell you, I don't know, and maybe, and why don't we change this, and that thing never happened.
Sure.
Now, you probably compounded 1,000-fold for a movie or a TV project, but when you're not your own boss, compromise. If you're not Steven Spielberg and you're not Ilya Kazan, compromise has to come into play.
Sure.
So
now you are known as an amazing inker, but after looking at your portfolio, you are an amazing artist. Your paintings that you have in there are amazing. What you draw is fantastic. Do you find yourself getting commissioned often to do other work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get commissions. I'm mostly a portraitist. Look, I love the collaboration of being an artist. I love the fact that I'm a little boy who's reading Kurt Swan Superman, and then I get hired to ink Kurt Swan Superman.
That's crazy.
Okay, that's crazy. Like magic. Or I remember the very first time I did a Batman job. It's like, oh, my God, it's Batman. It's not a drawing of Batman. This is Batman, and it's in, you know, and I got over that after like a day, but it's like I have now entered, as infinitesimal a part as I am, the legend.
Right.
I'm now part of DC and Marvel and all that sort of stuff.
When they tell the story, you're
going to be mentioned.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. But the thing is that I also, the comic books paid for my painting addiction. and I like collaboration very much. But I also have to do it all by myself too. I have to paint and draw away from comic books.
Is that where the push and pull is that you're talking about between collaborating and doing your own work without somebody interfering? Is that where the push and pull comes
from?
Well,
look, if some of my heroes are like, I mean, one of my absolute heroes is Joe Kubert. Okay. Frank Frazetta, no slouch. Okay. Mm. John Buscema. When these guys ink their own work, there's a confidence and a bravado,
right,
which I aspire to. But, and because, you know, anybody can take a ruling pen and a French curve and line, and if you practice, you're probably going to do a very nice professional job, and everybody's going to go, ooh, aren't you a good drawer, right? But I know how difficult it is to be spontaneous and allow handwriting to show up,
sure,
you know, your individual thing. So when you are walking and setting the trail, you can go any direction you want. You can be spontaneous and you can go backwards and up and down and left and right. But if we're following him,
sure,
and we don't want to step on the back of his heels, we got to pull back,
sure,
and pay attention. So when I, as an inker,
right,
I want to get a Joe Kubert feeling, if Joe Kubert drew
right,
it, I can't, because I'm going to have to follow him. So there's that pullback.
Right.
As far as my own artwork goes, if I'm doing a portrait of somebody and I say, okay, she's got a sort of a large nose, let's push it a little bit so that the whole point is brought across more. You know, the irony about reality, which is what I want to do in my work, is you have to make a reality bigger than life to look like life.
Interesting.
Okay? Because superheroes are, you know, people are about 5 1/4 to 5 3/4 tall. People are really pretty dumpy looking if you just look at them. Superheroes are gods.
Sure.
Superheroes are tall and long and big and muscular, and the girls have big breasts. So to make them look real, we got to make them look wrong to look right.
Interesting. Yeah. I think that was a compliment that was given to you, because I do not remember the quote itself, but somebody had said that when you ink their work, you make them the realest that they've ever looked. Now, that's par for the course for you. You are trying to put in a little bit of flaw.
No, not flaw. I'm trying to put in. Well, firstly, it depends.
Oh, okay.
Okay, because when I ink Jack Kirby, I don't try and make him real because he's Jack Kirby.
Sure.
And when I ink Kevin, what's his name? Ken McFarlane. What's his name?
Todd.
I don't want to dilute him. I don't want to make him fish nor fowl.
I see.
But if it's, for instance, Byrne. Okay, John Byrne, when I did Captain America with him, John said in an interview that he tried the first 10 years of his career to look like John, like Neil Adams. And then the next 10 years of a career trying not to look like Neil Adams.
Right.
So when I got the Captain America stuff to do, it was really, really lovely. It was at the height of John's power.
Right.
And I said, okay, I know to hink like Neil Adams. I'm going to push it 10% more in that direction. And people always speak about it as being a career high for both of us.
Wow.
But if John Romita Jr. gave me pencils to do, I'm not going to make them realer. I'm just going to try. It's a relay race. The guy has set the direction I'm supposed to run in. Mm. He hands me the baton. I don't go, nice idea, but I'm going to go this direction.
Right.
I go, okay, I'm going to go the way you want me to, and hopefully better, or at least do no harm.
You're keeping it honest.
I'm keeping it. If I respect the stuff,
correct.
Why would I want to turn it into something else? I just want it better of what it is.
Got it. Amazing.
Yes. Yeah.
Now we're almost out of time, sir, because I know you're on a tight schedule and all this other stuff. I had a question to ask, and then if anybody else was thinking of a question before we get out of here, please do while I ask this question. Is there any advice that you would give to artists in this current climate of comic books, artists, young artists, say like Todd and Theo, what would be your advice to these guys that are trudging along and doing books and trying to keep this alive? What would your advice be for these guys?
Well, again, I think you have to establish what your goal is. I was in Birmingham, England this summer at a conference, and there was this lady who had done these inks as good as anybody has ever done them in a kind of a a Jim Lee, David Finch kind of style. She worked so hard. They were as good as anything you ever saw. Says, they're going to hire you. And she showed the stuff to the editor, and they didn't hire her. We got anchors.
Wow.
And it's like, okay. I mean, and Mark Farmer, who's a longtime anchor of Alan Davis, was there and says, we have nothing else to tell you. I mean, it can't get better than what you did.
Right.
But they have somebody. So I can advise you on how you can make your work better. Maybe you look at what else is going on in the industry and try and don't be untrue to yourself. But, you know, don't ink like Milton Caniff if they're buying Jim Lee. Don't be crazy.
You know. Got it.
Right.
Got it.
But on the other hand, if you really have to do Milton Caniff, then, as you alluded to earlier, there's a lot of venues.
Sure.
And there are people who, for instance, will put up, they'll either like have a subscription to their stuff, like $1 a week for their strip, or some people will just put it up and say, if you'd like it to continue, can you please contribute something? There's people who will do whatever, 300 pages and go, okay, anybody want it printed now?
Oh.
And then they get the money up front.
Wow.
You know, and so forth. And you know, I mean, everybody has aspirations to do the next Men in Black or Walking Dead.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And I understand you want to be rich, you want to be famous. But any artist, I know Dickens was trying to make a living, but I think Dickens was trying to make art. And I think Herman Melville was trying to make art. I think you make the best thing you can make. And unfortunately, It's a Wonderful Life was not a hit when it came out.
Right.
But now it is.
Yeah.
And The Wizard of Oz was thought well of, but didn't win any Oscars that year.
That's correct.
You know? So look, why are we doing this stuff? Because we have to. Because it's fun. Because it's enjoyable. Because it's magic. Because it's what we always wanted to do. Because we have a story we want to tell.
Mm.
Tell your story, and then maybe find somebody who can go sell it somewhere while you're doing the important part, which is making it.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, gents, ladies, any questions for Mr. Rubenstein before we get out of here? Are we good? Todd, I know Todd's got something. Go ahead.
Well,
Todd.
He's asking about your Bogarting all the questions.
I'm sorry.
But I mean, I know you're interviewing.
I know, I'm trying.
I just kind of wanted to ask a little bit about the Hulk drawing that you did. When was it?
The comparison.
Of the Mike Zeck thing?
The Mike Zeck.
Yeah.
Was that the... is it true that that kind of led to the encyclopedia, the Marvel?
Yeah, well, what you're talking about is there was a magazine called Comics Scene.
Okay.
And edited by a guy named Bob Greenberger, who went on to be an editor at DC Comics.
Yeah.
And being feeling an unappreciated inker, I said, hey, Bob, when are you going to do an article about inking? and I probably said this to him every time I saw him, and he went, okay, we're going to do it. And I don't remember who got the idea, but they got Mike Zeck to do a Hulk drawing.
Of that pose of him stomping.
Yes.
Well, he's not stomping. He's sort of coming at it.
Yeah.
And so they got Tom Palmer, one of my heroes, Bob Layton, Klaus Janson, myself, to ink them, that figure. And then they put them side by side by comparison. Then we got together and they did a whole big interview on this thing. So I didn't even remember this happened until I read the interview years later. But Mark Grunwald, who was a very nice guy and an editor at Marvel and loved comic books more than life itself. I say this because when comic books started to disappoint him, he died.
I mean,
that's incredible. Holy cow.
Well, see, Mark became an assistant editor in chief at Marvel. And he was doing stuff that he didn't like to do, and he was telling people things he didn't want to tell them because the bosses were saying, you have to do this. And he was planning on getting out of comic books because his heart was broken, and his heart was broken enough for one day going to work. He died of a heart attack.
Oh, man.
Right. And I mean this. You know, jeez. I really do. But Mark decided that there was such a confusion in comic books. People were drawing people any way they felt like it. And they made people stronger than they should be, and all the facts were... He says, let's put out an encyclopedia called The Official Handbook of the Marvel Universe, and we'll get the fans to pay for it. because we'll put it out
as
every month.
As a child, reading that kind of stuff, like even the stats and the precursor to that, but was the Marvel Guide, and that is so much more interesting sometimes than a comic itself. Like just reading up the stats, seeing where they stand in comparison.
Yes, yeah. Because, but that's because, and I say this with all true love, a geek.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. And I get it. And I get, look, there's this website called IMDb, Internet Movie Database.
Sure.
And I'll be hours on that thing going, okay, look who was married to who when they made this movie, and I'll click to them and go, no kidding. Hey, you know, all that sort of stuff. So Mark decided to do the thing. So he came to me and he said, we're going to do this project, this encyclopedia thing, and here's 3 or 4 pieces we want you to ink. It was like a Brian Postman, 2 Ron Wilsons, and I don't remember what else. He said, ink these. And the reason he asked me is because when he looked at the 4 inkers on the Hulk, he felt mine was truest to the intention of what the pencils were, which is what I do. I want to be true to my penciler.
Sure.
And so I inked them. He says, okay, here they are. He says, okay, how many you want? I went, all of them. What answer would a person give?
Yeah, right.
I'll take 10. And it was the greatest job an inker ever had. First, it was easy because it was a big figure.
Yeah.
Secondly, I got all these wonderful pencilers who I never worked with before.
Yeah.
And I even made a point of going to people I admired, like Will Eisner, who turned us down. But but Kurt Swan drew his only Marvel thing for that. Joe Kubert, I'm one of 6 people in all of comic history who ever inked Joe Kubert because of that. John Severin, John Bolton, all kinds of people who never allowed anybody else to ink them. I inked Nestor Adando, Rudy Nebrus, and it was the best. And you know, and then eventually it went on to other things. But I felt very proud of my work, and Mark told me that basically I made their lives much easier because instead of coordinating 62 pencilers and 82 inkers, right, it was like everything came in, send it to Rubenstein.
Jeez.
And then I inked it.
Unbelievable. Now, you never, like you said, the word legend is something that kind of goes over your head, but
demigod.
I think that was the one I was looking for. But
Grand Poobah.
Right. At least for me, and I would assume some of these guys, your work and the people that you work with have been quite influential in all of our
lives.
I've
got chicken skin right now as he's dropping these names one by one.
It's fascinating and amazing to get into the mind and the interiors of what it takes to be a good comic book artist. So from someone who is influenced by comics, for me, thank you so much for influencing my life, I guess you could say even my social activities and how I think about these things.
You're responsible for his conservative beliefs, is what he's saying.
Maybe. I was just about to say, don't blame me for not being able to get a date.
But I definitely want to say thank you so much because it is your work that has influenced our lives and has influenced probably thousands upon thousands of people and artists across the world. So thank you so much for sitting down with us. We really do appreciate it. Thanks for coming to Maui and being part of Amazing Hawaii Comic Con. We certainly do appreciate it. So anybody else got questions for Joe?
Joe won't be at the con, actually.
No, he won't be.
That's false advertising. No. He's just here for this.
Oh, is he really?
And even an extra honor. Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Nope.
I guess we're very honored to have him here.
We are supremely honored for this.
I feel real special.
I do. I feel very special.
Actually, after this, I'm going back to the States for an hour and then going off to Tidewater Con in Virginia.
Wow. So, amazing.
And you know,
you hear that, Amazing Con? Right.
Well, you know, I was in Paris last year and I flew to LA,
mm-hmm,
went home to make sure my cats were alive, got back on the bus, went back to LAX and flew to Ottawa. So that was the same day.
See? So, the life of a comic book artist all over the world. Jet setter.
Yeah.
Absolute jet setter.
Can I just bring up one thing before you close
Absolutely,
out?
Sir.
Just this 1 minute later project that Theo and Joe had collaborated on. Basically, the concept is you take famous or known covers.
Printed covers.
Yeah. And what they did. Theo, maybe you can help explain the concept a little better.
Yeah, if the characters were doing something.
Sure.
original on the original cover, I would change it 1 minute later. So,
well, I mean, it's like the Hulk punches Spider-Man, and then the next is Spider-Man punching him back. You know, whatever happened 60 seconds. But sometimes it's like the character's laying on the ground defeated.
Jeez. And if working with a guy like Theo, because when I see his work, he's an amazing penciler. And staying true to his actual intentions is probably quite a collaboration between you two, is it not?
Yeah, well, like anything else, it's like you either decide that you respect the work and you don't want to change it, or you don't respect the work and, I got to fix this.
Sure.
Or the editor calls up and says, we don't like this, make something happen. Okay. And so I had five of these to Ink of Theo's. And, of course, I have every intention of trying to be true to Theo's intentions.
And he actually fixed some things that I didn't get.
He was true to the anatomy as well.
Right, right. Well, you know, within the parameters of what is his style, I can move things around, hopefully helping out something or another. Like maybe a light source, maybe something isn't catching the shadow.
Sure.
And, you know, all these things. And Theo doesn't work this hard so that everybody can go, ooh and ah. He does it because he has to, because he knows this is the way it's right. So when I'm working, when I'm done with a page and I erase it, it's fine. It's done. No one will know the difference. I still spend an additional hour per page getting that last eyelash to turn up, getting that little dimple in the lip or whatever the hell it is that nobody knows. But when I see if you spend the majority of your life, as I do, in a room alone, right, you'd like to be proud of it when it comes out and go, sure, oh, God, I hope they don't notice that that never happened. Sure. I used to Xerox every single page I got. And then when it was done, when my inks were done, I would put them side by side and I go, okay, what did I lose? What was there? What feeling was there that isn't there? And then you try and retrieve it.
Right.
You know, it's my obligation to the people I'm working with to try and get everything out of it that was given to me.
Sure. Right. It's amazing that Theo's work is if you guys don't know about Theo, his work is amazing. He's got a big portfolio you can check out. Fantastic independent comic book artist.
And another thing I just wanted to say about this project is they only initially requested one cover.
Did they really?
They didn't request any
cover. They didn't request anything.
Really?
I asked Theo to do a sample, and Theo did.
And he did six of them. Yeah. Six foot, and so they just ran with all six.
And then the client looked at it and went, oh, okay.
Of course, I'll buy all of them.
Yeah, I'll buy all
of them. And the weird coincidence was Theo, by complete chance, had selected covers that Joe had
actually
been the inker on.
Right, I'd been the actual inker on three of them.
So are you saying that Mr. Theo Lee is an overachiever? Is that what we're trying to say?
He seems very meticulous if you don't notice.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Joe, we certainly thank you so much for taking the time out to be here with us and to talk to us about your work and your legacy. You will be remembered long after you're gone, sir.
Whether you like it or not.
Whether you like it or not, you'll be remembered.
Don't give me a lifetime achievement award.
No, sir.
I'll die in like 6 months.
not at all. Okay. So I'd like to thank Joe so much for coming to the Nerdwatch podcast. I want to thank Todd, independent comic book artist, the artist of and comic writer for, of course, the Kukui Project. Theo Lee, an amazing artist and author of...
We're working on current projects.
Yeah. Good. And of course,
it's
all secret. And of course, Alika from Maui Comics and Collectibles. So until next time, peace out, much love, and most assuredly, always stay nerdy. And until next time, we say to you, aloha.